Hello, I'm Bill Redman.
Hi, Tony Faust here.
And I'm Kevin Yeo.
Welcome to Odin and Aesop, the podcast where we review and discuss military history books to help understand the events and ideas of the past. Some of these events and ideas shape our world today. If you're interested in learning more about the show, want to get a hold of us, or provide some feedback, please visit our website where we've got links to related material and contact information. Just Google odinandaesop.com, all one word. We'd love to hear from you. You can also follow us on Twitter.
Welcome to episode 39 of the Odin and Aesop podcast. Tonight we'll review Bernard Fall's classic, The Siege of Din Bin Phu, Hell is a Very Small Place. Published in 1966, it is one of the quintessential books on the battle that ended the French colonization of Indochina. In 1954, the French established a fortified airhead along the Laotian border in what is Vietnam today. The French were hoping the position would enable them to interdict the Viet Minh's attack into Laos. Instead, the Viet Minh chose to siege the French garrison and turn it into a pivotal battle for their independence. During the battle, the French would endure a 56-day siege by the Vietnamese and ultimately surrender their garrison. The defeat would result in the French being forced out of Indochina and the United States becoming embroiled in the Vietnamese Civil War a decade later. The book should generate a lot of discussion tonight, so let's get to it.
So, good evening, gentlemen. Welcome back to the Odin Aesop Transcontinental Studio. I trust both of you are ensconced in your bunkers, reading away. Bill, what's going on in the capital city of the free world?
Well, in the city, wouldn't know, but here at the Fortress Redmond, I have started the deliberate process of downsizing and organizing. As you know, we've been in the house a while. We have history here, which is one way of saying we have accumulated piles and piles of useless crap. So I have started clearing the clutter and downsizing. I have been very clever about this. You know, I didn't go marching into the daughter's room and tell her what I'm doing, but I started out in the shed and the basement. Don't worry, your pile down here is still safe. And then I stand back and I look at a well-organized closet and it boosts my mood. So anyone out there listening, that if you just need something to do to improve your life, downsizing's the way to go. If that stack of porn doesn't bring you joy, get rid of it, okay? Or, you know, you can just pass it on.
That's old school, Bill.
All right, but same idea. It does improve the life. So that's what I've been doing. Again, I know I live on the edge, and not many people can handle that level of excitement.
In that vein, I'm starting to pack because, you know, we are contemplating a move. So Julie went out and found a bunch of boxes somebody had just moved and wanted to get rid of. We rushed out there with the RAV4 to throw all these boxes into the back. In that process, I did brain myself on the tailgate, you know, the hatch. Which I, you know, you've seen that scar across the top of my head, which just keeps getting more scarred because I keep braining myself regularly.
Yeah.
So anyways, we now have a basement full of boxes, which I plan on start filling with a bunch of stuff we know we're going to move, but we don't use. I completely agree with what you're doing, Bill. Let me just ask you this. So what are you reading in between making sure that the 900 pairs of shoes you have, you actually want to keep?
Straight up, this is one of the books that Kevin gave me, Forward Surgeon, The Diary of Luther H. Wolfe, M.D., and Mediterranean Theater, 1943 to 45. So I'm still reading that, and it is fascinating. A couple of things. It is his diary, okay? So like each day or, you know, with a couple interspersions is basically just a paragraph of where he is and what he's doing. It's a fascinating look at his life, and it just day to day, there's nothing earth-shaking, but it is interesting what they're moving around through Africa and on up through Sicily and then on up on Italy. What I do find interesting is these guys are putting a lot of effort into getting better as time goes on by analyzing what they do. Like there's a couple pieces of medical equipment they don't have that they quickly realize, okay, we do need this. And then they also figure stuff out like it might brief well to have surgeons really far forward, and that is a good idea. But oh, by the way, you don't want them under artillery fire. That reduces patient care. You need them to where they can get to. So there's these trade-offs, but he's relating thoughts on how they're trying to get better. But it's a good read. So thank you, Kevin. And you got it for 50 cents. So there you go.
There you go.
Yeah, I might have to pick that up for me. I love that stuff, Bill. Like, that's the interesting stuff to me. The concept of people being deployed for years and years and years and just how that morphs into a lifestyle is very interesting to me. And by the way, did you know there were 16,000 dentists in the U.S. military during World War II?
Well, I do now, but no, I did not.
I think it was 1 in 4 dentists in the United States were in the military because the teeth were so bad that they, when the war started, you had to have X number of teeth to enlist. By the end, you could be toothless.
Again, something I just did not know.
Rick Atkinson is the king of these type of stories. He's a fascinating guy, and we're going to read one of his books in the future because one of his World War II trilogies, they're all excellent, but he frames exactly what the U.S. Army looked like in World War II, and it's pretty staggering when you think about just like that many dentists and vets and all the rest of it. So anyways, Kevin, what's going on down in Tennessee?
Hey, cold snap. And I'll give it to them. It's a legitimate -6 today. And the locals are saying it's the worst since 1993. But hey, I've been dragging around a container of cold weather gear from South Dakota for the last 6 years. And this is finally validating my pack rat tendencies. So I'm okay with it. Have been, you know, moving out, moving. I've been changing technology. So I've been making a lot of friends in India. All cell phone and internet providers, all the ions and electronics all seem to lead there. I've been doing that.
So Kevin, let me jump in here real quick. So you're actually on the other spectrum, right? So you've got Bill who's downsizing, who's throwing all of his stuff away. And you've been dragging these garments around for 6 years. But now they're paying off. So this is the dichotomy between downsized world and pack rat world. And I fit probably more on the pack rat world. But when you need that puffy, you best have it.
Yeah, I was able to walk out of our house here, go do my stuff, stand outside and watch the local maintenance guy freezing and laugh at him. So it was worth it.
Winning. Oh, by the way, Kevin, yesterday, you know, my fixation with people driving on my driveway with their snow on it because it creates ice.
Yeah.
So yesterday I discovered the flat metal shovel as the icebreaker. I don't know why it's taken me this long to figure this out because I'm such a dolt. But what a tool, Kevin. I was just busting ice off the driveway yesterday like a champion.
Been doing it years. And you need to wait till the right time of day when the temperature gets the mat and you get satisfaction peeling off huge pieces of ice and slinging them.
There you go.
I was the only person in the whole neighborhood, the whole entire like 4 blocks.
With a snow shovel?
With a snow shovel.
Winning. There you go. So Kevin, what have you been reading?
I've been reading War to the Death by Raymond Rudolph. It's the Sieges of Saragossa, 1808 to 1809, basically the French versus Spain. And it's been very, I'm going to send this around, very informative about early urban combat and how the French just get mired in the taking of these buildings. I'm not sure if there's any other works by the author, but this one is pretty good.
The war in Spain is supposedly so brutal. I'm very interested in reading that. So yeah, once you're done with that, let us endeavor to get it around to all sides. On my particular front, lots of reading, but the model production is going. I've got multiples going simultaneously. I'm finishing up the Sherman. I am painting a figure for it it's turned out very well, except for the face. I need to work on the face. Panzer IV is coming along nicely. It's many shades of gray there because it's all just a gray chassis. And then lastly, a Panzer IV chassis with a quad 20mm mount on top, which is an anti-aircraft version of it, which is kind of interesting.
So did you, when you make these models, like the Panzer IV, did you start with a straight whitewash like they did originally?
Actually, their original paint is red oxide is the base. And then what they do is they put on what they call Dunkelgel yellow, which is like a yellow. That starts like in 42. But before that, it was all like just a dark gray, right? So that's the base color. And then you have to color modulate it with a bunch of lightning in different places. It's interesting. I actually kind of like monochromatic paint jobs because then you can do a bunch of shading stuff with them. And I just keep buying models even though I'm going to be moving like a moron. It's so stupid, dude. I just bought three Tigers because they had this special deal where they bundle them in this huge box. Now I got this. It's so stupid. I'm an idiot. But besides doing all this modeling, I have been reading. And as per my New Year's resolution, I have been reading more than just military history. So currently I am reading Thank You for Being Late by Thomas Friedman. It's his latest book. And it's one of those books that is like kind of, oh, you know, they're modeling the future, right? And all the things that's gone on since 2007, that, you know, the all the revolutions and stuff. I like Friedman, but I find this stuff a little bit like heavy-handed, right? Just because you go to some corporation and some Weisenheimer gives you a bunch of the cool buzzwords, it doesn't necessarily mean it's real. Now, what he did say that was really interesting up front was, so if you were to think of a graph with two curves on it, one curve is the rate of change of like technology and process. And over time that's slowly, it's gone exponential, right? So things are changing at exponential rates now. But the people's ability to adjust to it, your adaptability, there's another curve on the same two axes. That's somewhat linear and much slower.
Think, and I'm guessing here from way, way, way back in the day, but when I was a kid, Mom and Dad had the book Future Shock on the shelf. And at some point, I remember reading it decades ago, but it was the same basic idea. People's ability to adapt wasn't keeping up with the rate of change.
It's the same graph. And so, you know, but now it's accelerating. I think one of the reasons why you see so many people with all this anxiety and they're so discontented is that it's this uncertainty based off of this rate of change and your ability to adapt to it. I mean, I think that's one factor. There's a bunch of factors why I think people are so anxious and they feel like they're falling behind. But that's part of it. And I thought that was well worth part of the book. Anyways, so I did that. I'm reading Going Infinite by Michael Lewis. It's his new book. It's about Sam Bankman-Fried. I like Michael Lewis. Sam Bankman-Fried is a bit of a tool. And then the last one I'm reading is Range by David Epstein. It's his second. It's a book that follows up The Sports Gene, which is excellent. And I'm plowing through all of them right now. But I'll give you the full debrief once I get through them. But anyways, that's that. So we're all busy, gentlemen. Bill, did we get any mail? I know we got at least one I saw in the hopper.
Yeah, well, we'll start off with one from Brian Stiles from Omaha, Nebraska. Found the podcast, listened to the episode on Gallipoli. Just wanted to share that a couple years ago, he was in Turkey on business, and during the weekend, he visited the battlefield, thought it was a fantastic trip, and said, yeah, you could easily spend an entire week and still not see everything, but thought unless you'd walk the ground, it's really hard to understand exactly what the Anzacs were up against. One of the aspects that struck him of Gallipoli is that a lot of the trenches are still there in many places, and the fact that the Turkish trenches were so close to the Anzac trench kind of shocked him. Anyhow, and he encourages anyone who visits Turkey to spend some time there and visit Gallipoli. They will not be disappointed, and says, thanks for the episode on Gallipoli, and please keep it up. And I'll throw out, again, I took the tour, and it was a whirlwind. Glad I did it. What I really remember is the cove, Anzac Cove. It was like, damn, looking at the old black and white picture, and there it is. And it ain't that big, and it looks exactly like it did in the picture. That jumped out at me. And you kind of got a sense this is a very significant place for the country of Turkey. So anyhow, appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Brian, for that email. Walking the ground really brings home any book or any review of a battle. And your comments really kind of excite me about our upcoming trip to Normandy next fall.
That's right. Gentlemen, we are going. Other people are signing up. This is a Odin and Aesop trip to Normandy. Now we got to get Bill on board. I'm putting pressure on him, Kevin. You know how I do this. It's passive pressure. But Bill is a busy guy. He's a busy guy, but we've got to get him there. And Karen, the whole crew, got to get the whole crew there. Bill, we can do it. We can do it. We could actually do the show from there, Kevin.
Oh,
okay.
From the beaches of Normandy.
There you go.
Okay.
The Lafayette Causeway. We could sit on the Lafayette Causeway and do the show.
Then we could go over to the bridge The Bridge Too Far.
Yes, I'm doing that too, by the way, for sure. If you want to come, Kevin, we're doing it. We're going to Arnhem because Jack is on board with the program. As a matter of fact, I owe him a call soon so that we can start mapping this thing out so we get our plane tickets early and get them for a cheap price. Good idea, Kevin. We're doing it. Bill, just a little pressure. And I know we got an email from one of our comrades. Fire away.
We did, changing the subject, but back to the emails. The other one we got was from Jeff Larson, checked on the net, and Jeff was a communications officer back in the day with when we were in 1-8, and he's now up your way, Tony, in Wisconsin. I understand you've exchanged emails with him offline, but we appreciate him reconnecting, and that's one of the reasons why we do this, and we wish him the best.
True. It was really good to hear from him. That guy was a good dude who persevered in pretty, to use the term, toxic command climate. And if you're the commo in one of those, you're not winning. So he did a really good job, I thought, of overcoming some of that toxicity. Quite frankly, I should have helped him out a little bit more with in terms of shielding him from it. But a good man, and it was always good to hear from one of the guys we served with, Bill. I'll have to get up to Milwaukee and get to a Brewers game with him so that I'll buy him a hot dog as an apology. Any other mail, Bill?
I think that's it for where we're at now.
Good. All right. So let us move on and get to your operational overview of Denman Food, because I am very excited about discussing this book tonight, gentlemen. I think it might be one of the best books we've read so far.
Thanks, Tony. Vietnam, or Indochina, became a French colony in the 1880s. It was occupied by the Japanese during World War II and declared independence after the Japanese surrendered in 1945. Vietnamese independence only lasted 20 days before the French reasserted control of their colony. This obviously didn't sit well with Vietnamese nationalists, the Viet Minh, who wanted their independence, and fighting between the two sides quickly broke out. The shooting between the French and the Viet Minh started in December 1946. Most military operations took place in the northern part of Vietnam and the Tonkin region. The French were centered around cities and ports, like Hanoi and Haiphong, while the Viet Minh tended to lurk inland, where it was harder for the French to get to. While the two sides were fighting, there were some initial negotiations about maybe giving Vietnam something like home rule while still keeping it under French dominion. Those discussions didn't lead to anything. While the fighting went on, a couple of things happened to change the calculus. First, the Chinese Civil War ended with communist victory in December 1949. Now, the Viet Minh had a staunchly anti-colonial ally bordering their territory who could help them with some serious assistance. We're not talking about small stuff. By 1950, the Chinese were helping part of the Viet Minh reorganize from a force of peasant insurgents into 5 full-up infantry divisions. Second, the Viet Minh changed their strategy a bit. They had suffered serious losses attacking French positions head-on. Instead of continuing these attacks on French positions, the Viet Minh military leader, Vo Nguyen Giap, decided to redirect his operations away from French centers of power and more into the French protectorates of Laos and Cambodia. The French commander, General Henri Navarre, saw what Giap was doing. To deal with it, Navarre decided he'd pursue the Viet Minh deep into their inland pseudo-sanctuary from where they were operating. He'd set up a hedgehog, a fortress, astride Viet Minh's supply lines, and then launch forays against them. The place he decided to do this is a valley called Dien Bien Phu. Tony, back over to you.
I've owned a copy of Bernard Fall's Siege of Dien Bien Phu since I was a sophomore in high school. However, ownership and readership are entirely two different things. There's no particular reason that the book never made it to the stack of books I keep on my nightstand for reading. Which is unfortunate, because although I had a basic idea what happened in the battle, it would have been helpful to know the details over the last 40 years. For example, Khe Sanh is routinely compared to Dien Bien Phu, and it would have been very helpful to know the differences between the two battles. Anyway, it's good to have finally read Fall's book, which is extremely detailed and provides its readers a day-by-day account of what happened in this pivotal battle. To begin tonight's book review, let me start with a little background on the author. Bernard Fall was born and lived in Austria until the Germans annexed the country during the Anschluss. His family moved to France to avoid persecution by the Germans for being Jewish. After the fall of France to the Germans, both of his parents would die at the hands of the Germans during the war. At age 16, he joined the French resistance and fought with them in the Alps until the end of the war.
After completing a degree in Europe, he traveled to the U.S. on a Fulbright scholarship in 1951. He went on to get a PhD at Syracuse and become an Indochina scholar. Fall would make 6 extended trips to Vietnam, starting in 1953, with his last trip there in 1967. Because of his experience in the resistance and the French army, he was able to study both the French and American military experiences by spending most of his time with the troops on the front line. However, he was also able to interview Ho Chi Minh and other North Vietnamese luminaries. In 1961, he wrote his most famous work, Street Without Joy, which covers the first war in Vietnam, 1946 to 1954. The title of the book was taken from the name given by French soldiers to a stretch of Route 1, which had been taken by their enemies, the Viet Minh. It ran along the central coast of Vietnam from Hue to Quang Tri. Ironically, Fall would die in the vicinity of the Street Without Joy in 1967 when he stepped on a mine that killed him and a Marine gunnery sergeant. A year before his death, The Siege of Dinh Binh Phu was published, which must have made it a book General Westmoreland read as the situation in Khe Sanh developed. 65 French transport aircraft arrived over Dinh Binh Phu at 10:30 November 20th, 1953. 3 minutes later, jump masters in each aircraft ordered the paratroopers in their aircraft to jump. In short order, the French had 1,500 men on the ground, and they rapidly started securing the village around Dinh Binh Phu, clearing the airfield so that aircraft could start to land there. Luckily for the French, 3/4 of the Viet Minh troops garrisoned at Dinh Binh Phu were in the field training more than 10 miles north of the village. The French were able to push the remaining Viet Minh troops in the area away from the drop zones so that by 1500, a second lift of paratroopers could land without resistance. By the end of the day, the French commanders were quite happy. They'd been able to land almost 1,900 paratroopers on a defended position 220 miles from their bases in Hanoi, while only sustaining 11 dead and 52 wounded. Over the next several days, the French continued to build up their combat power in the valley through additional parachute jumps. In total, the French landed 6 parachute battalions, which were deployed into 7 fortified positions around the airfield. The French commander set up his headquarters in the center of the defense, with defensive strong points, Huguette to the west, Claudine to the south, Dominique to the northeast. The other positions were Anne-Marie to the northwest, Beatrice to the northeast, Gabrielle to the north, and Isabel was isolated almost 4 miles to the south, covering a secondary airstrip. On November 26, 1953, the first transport aircraft landed in Dinh Binh Phu airstrip. With the aircraft came heavy artillery, engineering equipment, and tanks. By early December, the parachute battalions were conducting long-range combat patrols north of the garrison in order to link up with some mountain tribesmen. These tribesmen were friendly towards the French, who had a small special forces cadre living with them. Patrols were sent to the south as well in order to try to interdict Viet Minh movements into Laos. These patrols were long-distance and duration affairs that were resupplied by air. In December, these patrols ventured as far as 50 miles from Dinh Binh Phu. However, the Viet Minh conducted ambushes on the French combat patrols, inflicting high levels of casualties. In addition, the terrain and weather were brutal in the area around Dinh Binh Phu, so the patrols turned out to be physically exhausting affairs that did little to impede the Viet Minh activities in Laos. So by the end of December, the French continued to patrol, but only in the local vicinity of their strong points. This left the French with a choice for Dinh Binh Phu. They could recognize that the combat base would never serve as a mooring point for offensive operations and withdraw the force, or they could build up the defenses of the base and use it to attract Viet Minh forces away from the sensitive French targets in the Red River Delta. Essentially, they could use Dinh Binh Phu to draw the Viet Minh into a fight in which the French artillery and air power could kill them in large enough numbers to force the Viet Minh to the negotiating table. One byproduct of the French plan to use Dinh Binh Phu as an anchor point from which they could conduct offensive operations was a reluctance on their soldiers' part to properly fortify their positions. They would pay for this in the months to come. By January 1954, the 9,000 French soldiers defending Dinh Binh Phu were essentially isolated and completely reliant on aerial resupply. Over the next 3 months, the French would send out local reconnaissance in order to try to find Viet Minh artillery positions so that they could be targeted from the air. In general, they had little to no success in this endeavor due to Viet Minh's ability to camouflage their positions. In addition, the Viet Minh were very successful at conducting local security patrols around Dinh Binh Phu, which intercepted French units as they left their perimeter. It took General DeCastri, the French commander, until the new year to order his subordinate commanders to fortify their positions against 105mm artillery fire. In practical terms, this meant that the infantry needed to significantly improve their overhead cover. Specifically, they needed to put two layers of wooden beams, at least 6 inches in diameter, separated by 3 feet of closely packed dirt, topped by layers of sandbags, which were there to absorb the shrapnel. This overhead cover could not be in an area wider than 6 feet without additional support being added to the structure. Extrapolating this requirement to a battalion meant that each battalion would require 2,500 tons of engineering supplies, plus 500 tons of barbed wire and other defensive measures to protect them. So for the whole garrison of 10 infantry battalions and 2 artillery battalions, the French engineers calculated that they would need roughly 36,000 tons of engineering material. The only way to reduce this logistical burden was to substitute local materials for those brought in by the aircraft. The French quickly found out when they sent out woodcutting parties into the surrounding hills, they would be ambushed and forced back into the perimeter. So basically what this meant was the French Air Force would have to fly more than 12,000 C-47 sorties to just supply the required fortification supplies. At the time, the French Air Force could only generate 80 C-47 flights a day. So they were looking at least 5 months before the garrison would properly be fortified if all of the aircraft were used to just haul engineering supplies. That said, the commanders in Hanoi had already calculated that they would only supply the garrison with between 4 and 5,000 tons of engineering supplies. So it was decided that the materials that did come in would be used to fortify the headquarters command post, the signal center, and the X-ray room of the hospital. The rest of the base would have to do the best that they could. In the end, the battalions didn't get serious about trying to fortify their positions till about 30 days before the Viet Minh started their attack in early March. Bernard Fall provides the readers of the book an excellent description of all of the issues associated with the defense of Dien Bien Phu, which extended well beyond just engineering issues. In order to defend the garrison, the French put their faith in the capabilities of their artillery, armor, and air power. Starting in early December, the French would begin to transport dismantled tanks into Dien Bien Phu. They would bring in a squadron of American-made M24 light tanks. 10 of the 18-ton vehicles were brought in during December. Each tank required 7 aircraft sorties to get the parts into the base. Mechanics on the base set up a mini assembly line, which they used to turn out one tank every 2 days. Throughout the battle, one of the issues the French would have was keeping the tank squadron manned. Replacements for dead or wounded tankers would have to be jumped into the garrison up to the point that it fell in May. Once the French realized that the fight for the valley was going to be a battle of attrition, their headquarters in Hanoi decided to provide them with the firepower they needed to destroy the Viet Minh artillery by counter-battery fire. All told, the French would fly in 60 artillery pieces that they would distribute between the main defensive position surrounding the airfield at Dien Bien Phu and the defensive position Isabel, located 3 miles to the south. Their artillery parks contained 105mm, 105mm, and 75mm howitzers, which could be used for counter-battery fire. In addition, they had 120mm and 81mm mortars at their disposal, which they could use to break up Viet Minh ground attacks on their strong points. Colonel Charles Perroth would command the French artillery units charged with the defense of the valley. It was Perroth's view that the Viet Minh artillery would never be able to seriously impact the garrison for the following reasons. First, he didn't believe that the Viet Minh would be able to get their artillery pieces up into the hills that surrounded the French. Given the terrain, he felt that it would be too hard to get the guns into places where they could fire into the garrison. Second, if the Viet Minh did manage to get their guns into position, his artillery would be able to silence them rapidly with counter-battery fire. Third, even if he was wrong about the first two reasons, the Viet Minh would never be able to resupply their guns with sufficient ammunition to be a real threat. However, even though he was confident, he argued with the commanders in Hanoi that the garrison needed more firepower in order to defend itself. All of these assumptions that he made proved to be well off the mark. By the end of the battle, the Viet Minh had ringed the French positions with more than 200 artillery pieces and were able to fire into the garrison with impunity. Less than a week into the battle, Colonel Perroth realized how badly he had miscalculated and committed suicide out of a sense of shame. The last asset the French were counting on to win the battle was air power. They were confident that their air power would be able to interdict Viet Minh efforts to bring in reinforcements and logistical support. However, they failed to learn the lessons the Americans had learned in Korea several years before. The U.S. had learned in Korea that it was really difficult to stop large numbers of people dedicated to resupplying an army in the field. This was especially true in rugged terrain like the area around Dien Bien Phu. After the battle, General Giap would state that the battle was won because of the courage of the combatants and, to a large extent, the devotion and enthusiasm of the people's porters who resupplied the soldiers. Four other factors would limit the effect of air interdiction. First was a lack of reconnaissance assets to find the resupply routes the Viet Minh were using. Second, because the Viet Minh were able to get their artillery into the hills around the garrison, they were able to destroy the French air assets operating out of the airfield. Third, the weather limited the number of days the aircraft could be out searching for Viet Minh logistical units. Lastly, the French really didn't have the number of tactical aircraft they needed to accomplish the task. Remember, every aircraft dedicated to interdicting Viet Minh supplies resulted in one less that could be used to help defend Dien Bien Phu from an attack. So in the end, French air power failed either to destroy the enemy artillery or interdict them from bringing in supplies and reinforcements. By the way, the U.S. would struggle with the exact same problems 10 years later, but just at a much higher level. The Viet Minh started their assault on March 13, 1954. At the start of the battle, the French had a little more than 13,000 men in the valley. Of these, about 7,000 could be counted on as frontline combatants. Facing them, the Viet Minh had roughly 50,000 men and an additional 31,000 logistical support troops supplying them in the field. The Viet Minh also had 23,000 support personnel strung out along the 500-mile supply route to support their efforts to push supplies forward. The author devotes some time explaining the structure of the Viet Minh logistical efforts, and it's a great part of the book. Fall uses the description of the Viet Minh logistical efforts to highlight the political will the Vietnamese had to push the French out of their country. At the start of the battle, the French battle position named Beatrice was completely surrounded. The position was located on a piece of high ground, more than a mile northwest of the airfield. For more than a month, the airfield had been under sporadic artillery fire from the surrounding hills. More than a dozen aircraft had been destroyed by the time the battle began. At 1700, an artillery bombardment started onto the airfield, with the isolated Beatrice taking a particularly bad shelling. To everyone in the valley, it was clear that the Viet Minh were finally kicking off their long-awaited bid to defeat the French at Dien Bien Phu. Within an hour and a half, the Viet Minh had scored multiple direct hits on the command bunker on Beatrice. Over the next 7 hours, the Vietnamese slowly reduced the positions, eventually causing the French survivors to abandon their strong points and hide in the jungle until daylight, when it would be safer to approach the other sectors of the French defense. During their defense of Beatrice, the French had to fire more than 5,000 105mm artillery rounds, which accounted for more than 25% of their total stock. This highlights the tenacity of the Viet Minh, which had to brave an artillery pounding like that just to get to Beatrice. Within a day of taking Beatrice, the entire airstrip at Dien Bien Phu was untenable. Viet Minh artillery zeroed in on the aircraft revetments, destroying all of the aircraft on the field, including the light observation aircraft the French were counting on to use for counter-battery fire. 2 days later, the Vietnamese hit the northernmost strong point named Gabriel. They started their attack at 0300. During most of the 56-day siege, the Viet Minh conducted most of their attacks at night in order to negate French air power. Again, the Viet Minh were able to hit the position's command post. All of the senior officers on the strong point were standing together when an artillery round hit the CP with devastating effect. At the same time, all the radio sets connecting the CP to the rifle companies and General de Castries' headquarters were destroyed. In an instant, Gabriel was leaderless. By 0830 the next morning, the French had been pushed off the hill that Gabriel sat on. They had to retreat in full daylight under direct observation and fire from the Viet Minh on the crest of the hill. 30 minutes later, the survivors staggered into the strong points of Anne-Marie and Huguet. The fight for Gabriel had cost both sides dearly. Almost 500 men from the French units manning Gabriel were missing, of whom more than 80 had been killed. Two battalion commanders had been captured. All told, the French lost almost 1,000 men that night. On the Vietnamese side, the Battle of Gabriel had not been easy either. The French estimated that the Viet Minh had lost more than 1,000 men killed, with at least two times as many being wounded. To make matters worse for the French, General de Castries' staff appeared to be cracking up under the strain of these battles. The loss of Gabriel had caused Colonel Puroff, the artillery commander, to commit suicide by grenade. In addition, DeCastri's chief of staff had a nervous breakdown and had to be transported back to Hanoi. The day after the fall of Gabriel, the French reinforced Dien Bien Phu by dropping in a battalion of paratroopers. A total of 613 soldiers made the jump. Surprisingly, the French only lost 2 men in the jump, which is hard to fathom given the Viet Minh's ability to fire artillery onto the drop zone that they were using. After taking Beatrice and Gabriel, the Vietnamese commander, General Giap, decided to change his tactics to be more economical. Thousands of Vietnamese civilians were brought into the valley and were soon digging a huge communication trench system that was designed to surround the entire garrison of Dien Bien Phu. At this point, the strangulation of Dien Bien Phu had begun. New trenches were dug each day by the Vietnamese, and within days, the French discovered that there were trenches within 600 meters of Strong Point Claudine. When the French sent out patrols, regardless of their size, they ran into heavy fire and were forced back to their starting points. 2 weeks into the siege, something remarkable happened on the French side. Lieutenant Colonel Langlais, one of the garrison's battalion commanders, entered DeCastri's command post and bluntly told him that henceforth, the effective command of the garrison would be in his hands. There was never a formal change of command, but effectively on March 24th, Lieutenant Colonel Langlais assumed command without protest from General DeCastri. Surprisingly, this never turned into a conflict, and the two men were able to continue to work together. Basically, Lieutenant Colonel Langlais made all the tactical decisions, and General DeCastri continued to deal with higher headquarters in Hanoi. At the same time, the Vietnamese brought in large numbers of 37mm anti-aircraft guns and placed them on what used to be the Strong Point Beatrice. This made resupply flights by the French extremely hazardous. By the end of March, all flight operations into and out of the garrison had been stopped. This included helicopters and nighttime flights. This resulted in the French not being able to evacuate their wounded for the rest of the battle. This also forced the French to increase the altitude of the resupply drops from 2,500 feet to 8,500 feet in order to get out of the Viet Minh's 37mm envelope. The result was that the French would lose a much higher percentage of the supplies that they dropped into the garrison. At the same time, the Viet Minh continued to dig approach trenches towards the French positions. These trenches allowed the Vietnamese to approach the French strong points with protection from both direct and indirect fire. At night, the French could hear the Vietnamese digging, but other than sending out raiding parties to kill the engineers, there was little they could do about it. During the first 2 weeks of April, the Viet Minh conducted a series of attacks from both the southeast and northwest sides of the garrison. The Vietnamese were successful in taking individual strong points inside the defensive positions of A Linh and Hue Giet. They did so at extremely high costs, however. During one attack on A Linh, the French aircraft and artillery wiped out an entire Viet Minh regiment that they caught out in the open during daylight. The fights for specific strong points in A Linh resulted in a fortification changing hands multiple times over a several-day period. By the middle of April, the French were forced to abandon their strong points on Hue Giet, which meant that the Vietnamese controlled 90% of the airfield. This reduced the resupply drop zone to a very small area, making it increasingly hard to resupply the surviving French soldiers. French ammunition, food, and medical stocks continued to fall, causing the French to go on half rations and to conserve their ammunition at a time when they needed to fire continually to protect themselves. For the rest of the month of April, the French were slowly pushed towards the center of their defense. One of the most remarkable portions of the book was the author's description of how the French continued to try to reinforce their garrison with replacement soldiers. Weather permitting, every night in April and early May, they would conduct night jumps into an ever-shrinking perimeter. The author paints a vivid picture of the French transport aircraft circling the garrison at night with replacements on board, waiting to jump in. In many cases, these aircraft would have to make multiple jump runs because the drop zones were so small they could only get a couple of soldiers out of the aircraft at a time. The French continued to drop soldiers in until May 4th, just 3 days before the Viet Minh took the final strong points. On May 1st, the Viet Minh started their final assault by attacking all the remaining French strong points on the defensive positions of A Linh, Dominique, and Hue Giet. The French fought desperately, but were slowly ground down. By May 7th, the French were down to 3,000 men when the Viet Minh launched their final assault with 25,000 men. At the same time, the remaining French soldiers defending Isabel to the south attempted to break out with the intent on reaching French forces in Laos. What would come after the French surrender on the 7th was horrific. More than 10,800 French prisoners of war would have to walk 370 miles to their prison camps. Of the 10,800 men that started the march, only 3,300 would be repatriated 4 months later when the French and Vietnamese agreed to end the war. To put that into comparison, during the Bataan Death March, it was only 65 miles long. That said, the Japanese were much more brutal to the Allied prisoners than the Viet Minh were to the French. But let me be clear, the French POWs were starved, beaten, and killed as well, just not as badly as the soldiers during the Bataan Death March. But having to walk 370 miles after fighting 56 days is an incredible feat of endurance. The book provides its readers fantastic detail on the aftermath of the battle, which I found fascinating. Of all the books that we've reviewed so far, this one might be the most interesting one to me, primarily because Dien Bien Phu is one of those battles that seems to have receded in history, even though it was vitally important. For me, this book was so enlightening that I had a hard time putting it down. It also dispelled many of my biases about the French army's ability to fight. The French soldiers' courage during this battle is hard to refute. The fact that they had people volunteering to jump into a hopelessly surrounded garrison all the way up to the end of the battle speaks for itself. If you want to understand the American Vietnam experience, you really need to read this book. What it will show you is the extent to which the Vietnamese would go in order to achieve an independent country. Another feature of this book is the number and quality of the maps that it contains. Because the French garrison was a collection of defensive positions with female names that each contained 5 to 10 strong points, it was critical to have good maps to follow the action. And the book certainly does. So if you like to read about colonial wars of the 20th century, this book is a must read. I promise you, if you read this book, you will enjoy it. Bill and Kevin, that was my book review. As you can tell, I'm really glad we chose to review this book this month. I think it was spot on. But I'm really interested in your thoughts, which I suspect are going to be pretty eclectic. Kevin, what did you think of Hell is a Very Small Place? Was it worth your time? And would you recommend it for others?
It's worth the time to read because of the history, the information that the author gives, and just the things that you could pick up from this, especially on a professional level. But for me, not enjoyable to read. Like the first third of the book, the author writes, it's almost an argumentative style. He'll state something and then proceeds to make a case for it. I mean, he does it with facts and with interviews and different documents, but it wasn't an easy read for me the first third, because the author also seems to make the assumption that the reader knows the basics about this battle and about math. And I think that's because of where and when he was writing it, which was, you know, at the end of the Vietnam War from the U.S. side. So style-wise, the first portion wasn't an easy read. Later in the book, though, it does become easier to read, and it is very informative. Still from the perspective, I think, of 67, though. Overall, I liked the book. I liked the information. Well worth the time. Just not the easiest for me to read.
Fair enough. Bill, what were your thoughts?
Just a couple ideas. Is one, I did not find it as difficult, possibly, as Kevin did, but I knew the basic story of what happened, but this book filled in large parts, things that, you know, the big rocks that I probably should have known about beforehand. You know, two of them come to mind is one, I didn't realize how many non-French troops were there. And even knowing that, okay, yeah, it's got a large contingent of Foreign Legion, but just how many non-French troops were there. And also, I did not realize the direct connection between this and Korea and China in the mind of other people. They all viewed this as part of one greater interconnected problem. I had never realized that. The last thing that struck me was just how applicable what this story could be today. And I think we're going to talk a lot about that, as some of the things took place, what, 70-something years ago? But this idea of, you know, sending a force deep into bad guy country and you're doing it for specific reasons, but there's some risk to doing that. And this book explains some of them.
I think those are good points as well. And we're going to talk about a couple of them in more depth. Let's start with this concept of going deep to create some type of issue for the enemy. And there's kind of a desire, and it's very sexy, and then there's the reality of these type operations. Let's talk about that a little bit.
It does have an appeal. On paper, it opens up where your next moves can be. Instead of just having, you know, being a pawn and taking one step forward, using the chessboard analogy, you can be the queen and show up anywhere on the board to your advantage and to the enemy's disadvantage, and it maximizes surprise. So yeah, it's got this appeal to it, But nothing in life is that simple, I don't think.
Also, it's kind of like a defense in the sense that it's an economy of force. One of the appeals is, hey, we can just put this small force in the enemy's rear, and with artillery or air support, we can cause all this havoc and make the enemy devote a lot of resources to cleaning this up in their rear areas.
When you look at strategically or operationally, what were the French trying to do? They were trying to draw the Vietnamese. They were trying to do, we'll get into this too, that they weren't really clearly defining what they want to do. But at the end, what they were doing is drawing all of this Viet Minh manpower to Dinh Bien Phu away from the Red River Valley, which is the areas that they wanted to protect. And their view was, hey, if I give them a problem here, they've got to take assets from another place and move them there. And so you're right.
Yeah, and they are drawing enemy forces away from their center of gravity, but they are also sitting astride of the Viet Minh supply lines. So they're creating issues with them, which is creating issues for what the Viet Minh's trying to do in Laos and Cambodia. So theoretically there's good reasons for doing these things, but you kind of got to have your eyes wide open, or else you're going to end up out there by yourself, naked and afraid. And he talks about a lot of the problems they had.
It was good timing that we had this book after Cornelius Ryan's A Bridge Too Far, right? Because in many ways, they parallel each other and they have similarity. And there's this interesting question, really, I want to kind of pose to you, is this, what is the relationship to payoffs worth the risks on these things?
Can it work? Yes. You got to be very, very realistic in your appraisals, though. As simple things, examples he uses in the books, there's a direct applicability to Bridge Too Far also, but things like, okay, fresh water. I get it. There are sources. People can live off the land, but you have thousands of guys a long way from home. Where are they going to get water to drink? And if you don't have a realistic appraisal and solution for that, it's going to be a problem going in, and it was certainly a problem for the French. And we haven't even gotten to food, ammunition, casualties, and every other thing, but that's a simple one. It impacts the French.
Before any operation, not only just this style, but any operation, the leadership has to have two critical things done. One, they have to have a clear mission, and I think we're going to talk about that. But the other thing they have to have is they have to have a critical, realistic evaluation of their own capabilities. What can I actually do? And if the leadership doesn't have that, then everything's going to fall apart because, like you said, Bill, you don't get enough fresh water. Bubba doesn't have ammo. We don't have a solid plan on how to deal with these logistics issues, not to mention, how do we handle when things go bad?
Great point, Kevin. The flip side to that coin is you better have a realistic understanding of your enemy as well. And I think the French fairy dusted a couple of things with the Viet Minh in terms of what they thought they could and couldn't do.
Yes. The top of the list has got to be the French fallback in their mind was, okay, we can outgun these guys. If it gets really bad, we are going to be able to, we're going to be packing more firepower, artillery, and air support than these guys, and that can tilt things in our favor. And that did not happen. And it ended up with the artillery commander committing suicide because of it to restore his honor. I'm not blaming the man for them lowballing the enemy's capability, but that was an issue that came to the forefront right away.
It is right away. Even in the book, it's right away. The staff is telling the commanders that the Vietnamese, the artillery of the Vietnamese is superior both in numbers and in observation. And observation is one of the key aspects of this whole thing. This is one of the few battles where we can look back and say, look, your staffs were giving you honest appraisals of some of these things. And you chose to ignore them.
I forgot about that, too. It was not only are we outgunned, but these guys are looking down on us and can see everything we're doing. Meanwhile, we can see very little of what they're doing. So that takes an already just a numbers problem and makes it much worse.
that's a great point from both of you. And what I thought was interesting is that they had these very senior commanders, like the Secretary of Defense and what their chief of staff of the army show up from France. And they're taking a tour in October and early November, well before the siege starts. And they're looking up in the hills, and the artillery commander is pontificating about how he's going to counter-batter everything and not to worry about it. And they're like, I don't know. And he mentions, like, he has a direct quote in there of, like, the chief of staff of the French army going, this isn't going to be like the other things. This is not going to go well. But he doesn't do anything about it, right?
You even see it towards the end of the book when the whole thing is going south. And they're trying to cover their own asses, if you will. It's the fault of these different observers that came in. Nobody told us this. They go into, you know, the chief of staff came and visited. All these foreign observers came and visited. And none of them told us that our bunkers weren't built correctly. Well, I think that's pretty much your own responsibility at that point.
For sure. My point really is, though, that you're right, 100%. You can say that, but the reality is, even they, who just showed up for 4 hours, could see that this is a problem. And you guys could see that this is a problem. But when you start fairy dusting things, this is a very critical point. When you just start taking people's capabilities off the table by wishing them away, you've got a problem.
That is another fundamental thing I had never even thought about, but he explains it in great detail in this book, is, okay, the enemy's going to show up with a lot more artillery than we've got. They're going to be looking down on us. Okay, we need to dig in. That is going to require enormous, you're never going to fly in that amount of engineering stuff, specifically timber for overhead protection. It's not happening. And he's got the numbers in there to put so many thousands of guys under that kind of protection. That miscalculation, that fairy dusting the problem away, jumps out immediately on him.
The other thing that I took away from this is, when you go and you do these long range operations, you need to have a couple things figured out. One, you better have an extraction plan. Like, if this thing goes south, how are we getting these 10,000 guys out of here? And two, you better have the ability to evac your casualties. Because if you can't get your casualties out, well, they've just become an anchor, because you ain't leaving then. And the French, God bless the French, they're like, we'll leave a couple of doctors and everybody else is going to bolt. That's your choice. If you've got casualties, like significant numbers, and they had hundreds of casualties within a week of the siege starting, well, you're leaving them or you're stuck.
And it flips your decision-making, your reasons upside down. You had done this initially because it opens up a whole new world of maneuver. You're not just going to be restricted to taking that one step forward. Well, now that you're committed, now your options are limited. You were stuck to that point. Now, again, there might be good reasons for doing these things, but you got to be very realistic, you know, in your risk and benefit analysis before you do it. And then you could end up being stuck there, which undoes the whole idea of, I'm going to open up new further options for myself.
A micro version of this is a reconnaissance team, right? And this is the age-old problem with reconnaissance, is how much manpower are you going to put in these teams? The smaller the team, the more stealthy they are, and the easier they are to hide and find it. But the smaller that team, they take one casualty, and they're going to fight from where they take that casualty. They are going to fight and die from there, or fight and get extracted from there. They're not moving. If you have a four-man team, one guy gets dinged in the leg, you're stuck there.
And you're at 25% casualties, and your other three guys can't. Pretty hard to carry anyone that far. I don't care who you are, by the way.
There's hundreds of examples of this out there. If you look at Red Wing, right? Those guys, they had a four-man team, and one guy gets dinged, and then you're going to fight and die from where you get hit. It's really, really hard to move anybody, because that's one less gun you're going to have just helping them out. So anyways, that's a micro version. You got a macro version here where you've got hundreds of casualties. And what the heck are they going to do? Well, they're going to stand and fight for 56 days.
This battle with the French is a precursor to SOG in Vietnam for the U.S., the fire bases in the U.S. There's a lot of, I guess, similarities that we see going into the Vietnam War for the U.S.
And today you also see it every concept of operations and every glossy brochure that I read, and again, I'm not bad-mouthing it. There's good reasons for doing this, but it's got Ospreys going deep. It's got long-range, Army's long-range aviation, the tilt rotor Blackhawk, whatever they go with, but it's all about dispersal and going deep, which, again, I'm not bad-mouthing the idea, but it runs the risk that these guys face. So it has got great applicability to what we're trying to do today. I don't care if it's coming from over the horizon from a sea base and landing hundreds of miles inland or deep maneuver with the Army with their future long-range aviation. This book's got applicability to what they're trying to do.
You look at the Marine Corps concept of ship-to-maneuver warfare, right, where you're going to go from the ship all the way to the objective, no Iron Mountain. You're going to hit the objective and then get the heck out of there, right? You got to make sure that back door is open to get the heck out of there. You get stuck in there, it's going to get real bad real quick. So anyways, lots of lessons like you were saying, Kevin. It's unfortunate that this book came out in 1966 and instead of 1962. Yeah, what's up, Kevin?
One last thing on estimating your own capabilities and looking at the enemy's capabilities. If you look at the French battalion at this time in Indochina, their makeup, equipment-wise, kind of gives you an indicative of what terrain and kind of battle they're trying to fight. I'll just rattle it off here. 624 rifles, 133 submachine guns, 41 bars, 481 millimeter mortars and 860 millimeter mortars. Now you compare that to the 304th Vietnamese division, 500 rifles, 200 submachine guns, 20 bars, 4 mortars, 81 millimeter, but then they have 3 recoilless cannons and 3 bazookas. So you see that the Vietnamese are prepping for the close-in fight in that type of terrain, a lot of firepower, not so much distance, and they're not worrying so much about, at that level, having that indirect fire capability, while the French are trying to stand off and do their thing. No bazookas, no recoilless cannons, a lot of heavy equipment, because you're carrying mortar rounds. That's a lot of work.
Let's transition a little bit and talk about that, right? Again, it gets to estimating your capabilities and underestimating the enemy's capabilities effectively or ineffectively in this particular case. Let's talk about this concept of air interdiction, where you're going to use your air power to disrupt the enemy's supplies so badly that they'll have to pull away from you in one of these type of operations. Let's get into air interdiction.
The basic idea, if you've got two groups of people sitting there shooting at each other, gee, wouldn't it really tilt things in your favor if an airplane drove over and dropped a bunch of ordnance on them? And if you can do that, like the French could, well, then it becomes a good idea. And then you think about it some more. It's like, wait a minute, why don't we do that before we ever even have to fight them? Why don't we interdict them before they get here with all their stuff? So yeah, it's a good idea. It makes sense. And in this case, he talks a lot about how they were trying to interdict that. I forget, I think it was Rural Route 28 or something, but there was a road coming down towards the valley, and that's what they were trying to interdict. So in theory, it made sense, but is it going to fix all your problems? Probably not.
The French had the U.S. example, who thought they could do the same thing in Korea, and they were unsuccessful in Korea, right? The Air Force, the U.S. Air Force really did think they were going to stop the Chinese ability to move supplies down to their front line, Korea, and they failed miserably. And yet the French thought they could do it here in a worse environment.
Now, when I think air power, air interdiction, air resupply, I think unreliable, because every time we've looked in any of these battles, it always seems that the air arm of the force gets plagued by either equipment problems, weather problems, training problems, personnel problems. It is the most unreliable logistics systems that you can have. As we look at this, you see the French, I just love it. The French have this big argument on who is a qualified parachutist. The guy, when he hits the ground, we want him to be able to fight, but we need to train him. And they're just like, no. At a certain point, they're just like, just put him on the plane. It's one jump. We'll push him out. He'll be fine.
I just thought this was a classic case of, again, the enemy gets a vote. And when you say you're going to stop an enemy's logistical system via air, the Viet Minh and the Vietnamese, that the North Vietnamese that the U.S. fought, were seasoned, hardcore guys that would find a way to counter whatever you were doing. And one of the things that the author in this book describes the Viet Minh's logistical system, even here, was it was kind of like a river. And if you dammed it somewhere, it would just flow to another way to keep those supplies moving. And I also thought it was very interesting at the end of the book when he talks about General Giap. He gave so much credit to the logistics guys for doing this. And they built a blueprint for what they were going to do on the Ho Chi Minh Trail 10 years later.
Yeah, that's a good point. He talks about right when the French started doing this, the Viet Minh immediately started adapting. So the basic idea is, okay, we got to have our airplane directly over their supplies to drop ordnance on them and interdict what they're doing. You start doing that, and the Viet Minh, which is hard enough to arrange itself because it's hundreds of miles from wherever, you're staring at the ground, people are trying to remain concealed. The Viet Minh immediately start adapting, specifically, okay, we're going to start tying trees together, we're going to camouflage where we're at even better, and oh, by the way, if we know the choke points you're going after, you're going to be flying in some air defense artillery too, and the Chinese are more than happy to help us do this. So it's not just a fixed problem. You're going to step in a different river each time you try and do this, and they are going to start trying to adapt to what you're doing. In this case, yeah, they spread out, and they brought in a lot of air defense. They set up corridors for air defense traps for the French to fly into, and they just changed the tactical picture. Not saying that interdiction can't work at all, but just to say, oh, well, that's going to be our answer and problem solved, probably not so much.
The other part of that, Bill, is the terrain. The terrain in Indochina means that the resupply effort can go not only foot mobile, bicycle mobile, truck mobile, train mobile, ship mobile, Saipans, canoes. You have all these different methods of getting resupply into an area. While if it was maybe an island or a ship or just a railroad, yes, it would be much easier. But because they have so many different methods of getting the logistics in, air power just doesn't seem to be able to do it.
Yeah. And Tony, like you said, yeah, I never thought about that. This, they could have looked at what was going on in Korea, where the Chinese, a lot of them, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and they were being resupplied by essentially large groups of porters carrying it all in by hand. And air did not stop it. And they adapted by moving at night. And people do this today also. It's as simple as, okay, we're going to put everything in the parking garage and they cannot see what's in here. Or transport it in non-military vehicles and it complicates what they're trying to do. So the same idea, the same issues do apply today.
There's a balance, right? Air power relies, like you were talking about earlier, Kevin, relies on a bunch of other factors, right? You've got weather that is, and by the way, the weather in Dien Bien Phu was horrible because it's rainy and low clouds and scuddy all the time. That's not good for aircraft trying to kill things on the ground. But what it does is you have all these outside factors, but one of the key factors is there's only so many aircraft, and the French did not have an abundance of pilots or aircraft. And what that generates is for every sortie you go and launch to do interdiction, okay, we're going to hit these trails 50 miles from the battlefield and stop the supplies from coming in, is one aircraft you don't have for close air support, which the guys in the engagement need. So the French are trying to balance this issue, and they don't have the assets to do that successfully. And I suspect if they had 10 times the assets, they might not have been able to do it successfully. That's why they were trying to lean on the United States to help them.
Yeah, the finite quality of what they were working with comes out. He talks about the Naval Corsair Squadron. The courage and skill of the pilots wasn't in question at all. But after a certain period, they were spent. They were done. Everything, they lost a lot of people. They'd taken a lot of damage, and they were just done, and they were not going to be tilting the tide. So, yeah, it's a very finite quantity, and it takes a big support effort to even come close to being able to make it work like it should.
The guys on the ground would give a percentage of supplies that landed within their LZ or their landing zone or where they were trying to parachute the supplies into. And they'd give that percentage. And when you think about it, the French are using that percentage to try to do that juggle, just like you're talking, Tony. They're trying to figure out, well, if we want to get 100% of our supplies in that these guys need, how many more planes are we going to need to have dropping? Because we're only getting a 20% success rate of dropping it into the field. So we've got to drop like 400% more stuff. So it was crazy math that it was driving. And like you said, they just didn't have enough planes to do that.
So let me ask this one final question on this segment is, you know, given the differences in technology today, let's talk a little bit about the possibility of doing air interdiction today and what technologies would drive us to be successful where they weren't then.
Long duration drones would help greatly, because then, you know, you got that unblinking eye looking at whatever, you know, river crossing or road junction or stretch of supply route. So yes, long duration drones would help you greatly, but those things are vulnerable. People have shown that they are vulnerable, but that comes to my mind. And well, in the integration of digital comms, targeting seems to shorten the kill chain. But again, those aren't panaceas.
And I believe the Marine Corps has been experimenting with logistics drones. So your drone, it might only carry a couple hundred or 100 pounds of equipment, but it's getting exactly to that landing zone. Now, the enemy does have a vote, though, on all these drones. I would imagine that the drone defense could also stop logistics drones also. And they might even be a little bit easier to bring down.
I would also probably throw in sensors. It takes the night advantage and disrupts it a little bit. You still have an advantage, but with thermals and some other sensors that you have out there, you can still track things at night. And then, which makes them, it's actually safer for the aircraft. You also have precision weapons. So you have cluster munitions. You have a whole bunch of technologies that have been invented since 1954, when this battle took place, that would potentially make it more likely that you would be successful with air interdiction. Now, that gets a vote. And like you were talking about, Bill, people are ingenious. You can make it really hard, no matter what technology you have, to be successful. So I would be very interesting today if we were to take the U.S. technology we have today and apply it to Vietnam 1968 on the Ho Chi Minh Trail and see what the Vietnamese would do to counter it. I would be voting on the Vietnamese just because I think that people are pretty ingenious.
Yeah. I mean, they thought their way around the French in the early 1950s, and then the U.S. came in with a generational leap in technology and sensing targeting capability and just scale of interdiction capability. And the North Vietnamese at that time still kept things moving down the Ho Chi Minh Trail despite everything the U.S. was trying to do and scale in technological advantage. Yeah, things have changed, but it's still not a panacea. People are going to think their way around what you're trying to do.
I think you always have to remember that man is ingenious. And what we saw in the Ukraine is that the Ukrainian civilians who turned soldier quickly adapted drone technology to their use too. So as you said, Tony, the enemy does get a vote.
So let's shift gears here. Bill Belichick always says this in football. Great players can't overcome bad coaching. And in this particular case, I'm not sure that a flawed strategy can be solved by technology. You know, there's some real issues there. Let's start off really kind of what was the French operational objective by doing this, and where was the disconnect?
I think they're objective here, and I read it a couple of times because it kind of it involves, okay, we're going deep into Dien Bien Phu, and we're going to disrupt what the Viet Minh are trying to do in Laos and Cambodia. We're going to disrupt sort of their sanctuary, where their stomping grounds, and we're going to cut off that supply route. But it's a little bit amorphous in terms of, oh, no, we're going to build a fortress, or are we going to build what they call a mooring point and operate out of there? But the operational objective is still like, okay, we're going to go set up in the Viet Minh backyard and disrupt what they're doing. What I'm unclear on, and I've been trying to find out, is beyond that, what was the French plan for winning in Vietnam? And I can't, other than kind of vagaries about maybe setting up, putting a Vietnamese face on colonial rule or whatever French dominion, it's a little bit vague and I can't figure it out.
The only French unification and strategy is at the very beginning of the book, when they talk about disrupting the Red River Valley or the logistics flow into Laos.
There is no unity of command here. There's a lot of people with their own ideas. And what I found interesting is that there were a lot of French commanders that were very pessimistic that this was going to work and then this could turn out really badly. And yet they still did it. And this is high-level people. In some ways, as you like to say, Bill, the circumstances defined what was going on rather than you defining what was occurring, right? So they let circumstances get to them here. And I thought that was kind of an interesting part. And the author does a good job of describing that.
As a staff officer in the French, you had a backpack full of fairy dust because you had all these guys that were like, you know, this probably isn't going to work that well, but our artillery, that'll work, or our different technologies, that's going to overcome these deficiencies in strategy.
Let's talk about that. What you're really talking about is they made some assumptions, right? The planners made some assumptions on the French side as to how this thing was going to go based off of their operational kind of vision. And you're right, Bill. Their original operational vision is we're going to build this combat base deep in the rear of the enemy's safe areas, and we're going to operate from there. What assumptions did the planners use that were flawed that cost them dearly later on?
One was that the force size that they were sending in would be able to defend this entire valley. And no, so that's one.
That's a really good point. As soon as they got into this valley and they started building these different strong points, the ones that are all named after women, they figured out they didn't have enough guys to cover this whole area. It's a massive area. And given the terrain, it eats up a lot of people. Did you get the same thought?
I did. When they finally get there, they figure out, ooh, we can't defend this entire valley. So they immediately surrender the high ground that rings it because it's unrealistic for them to occupy all of it. And then they decide, okay, we're going to fortify parts of it, like Beatrice and every other female name they could come up with. And then that leaves a lot of, well, one, it sets them up to be taken individually, which is what happened. It also creates problems with trying to coordinate actions between these places. So, yeah.
Well, let me just do a quick description for the listeners who may or may not have read their book. But so what the French do is they have a central location where the headquarters is, and then they create these strong points that they're going to defend that from. The airfield is really what they're concerned about, because they need an airhead to bring in supplies. And these individual strong points are basically defended by individual battalions, and they're named after female names. But each name is A through H or G or something like that, right? But they're not necessarily, many of those positions weren't mutually supporting, and you were isolated. So like you earlier, you talked about, Bill, just getting water for some of these positions was a big deal, because the Vietnamese would just ring these individual strong points and crush that strong point and take it. Because again, if you can't get water, it's really difficult to fight.
Yeah. Well, that was another of their assumptions. Well, our planning was, okay, we've got a river running through this valley. We can drink out of it. Well, maybe not. And they ran into problems with that once these individual strong points started coming under pressure. And so they got problems there. And you're not going to be able to fly in enough water for everyone. So it's a problem.
Let me rephrase this a little bit different. Because they're tied to technology of the resupply by air, they have to protect the landing zone or the airstrip. Then if you're going to protect that, you don't have enough people to do protect it against both threats. If you're going to protect it against the individual or the small unit getting up to the edge of the airfield and then shooting with a direct fire weapon, you have to have enough people to surround that thing and do that by, they chose strong points. So with the terrain, that means you have to be relatively close to the airfield to stop that. But at the same time, you have a threat of the artillery or the indirect fire, and that means you have to be up on the hills because you have to stop the enemy from being up there. And the result is you don't have enough people to stop both threats. You have to choose. So they choose to strong point close in, and they give up the high ground and the indirect threats. That's how I see it.
They make the assumption that they're going to negate the indirect threat with artillery. Because the French have a long history in artillery, and they're very, I think that's one of their strengths. So their idea is our counter battery is going to negate the long indirect fires. And so what we do have to do is protect the airfield. So again, but they make this assumption that they're going to be able to do that.
Yes, that is going to be their hammer that they can bring against the Viet Minh. It turned out to be the opposite. The Viet Minh showed up and outgunned them, and they were able to look down on them from the high ground, so they were able to observe them a lot better. And just to kind of illustrate this point, yeah, the French artillery commander that was so confident in all this did commit suicide when it didn't pan out. But that was their fallback. Here's how we're going to keep this place ours.
Are there any other assumptions you think that were faulty? Their planning was based on these assumptions. It's not like, they morph these assumptions. When they went in, they said, we can do these things, and that's why we're going to be set. What other assumptions did they have?
Relative to the enemy, I think they assumed they would be unable to sustain that level of force in that area. The force that the Viet Minh would be able to field and bring against them would be a lot less than they did.
Right. They could not resupply. One, they felt they could interdict the supplies. And two, they didn't feel that the Viet Minh had the capability to resupply artillery ammunition specifically to those pieces that were going to be up in the hills that were shooting at them. So that was a faulty assumption.
I think one of the biggest things that I found, and I found it a couple different sources, so I think it's true. In October of 53, the Chinese advisor, General Wei, gave Ho Chi Minh a copy of the French plan. The French made this assumption that they were fighting and the enemy would react to them, and we're going to drag them in there and we're going to be able to interdict it. But the Vietnamese are going into the game knowing the plays, knowing the plan.
Because of that, I think that they believed that they could resupply this garrison 220 miles from Hanoi without any problem from the air. And Kevin, you've talked about this throughout the thing, but the problem with that idea is, they're not going to get regiments of Chinese anti-aircraft to ring this place and make this a really difficult place to land or drop supplies into. So as you read the book, right, you see that the French go from dropping at 2,500 feet to 10,000 feet. So if you're dropping equipment under parachute from 10,000 feet, you got a lot of drift. That also means you got to get above that scud clouds, right? And to do these aerial drops, you need to either have radar down on the ground or some signal that you know exactly where the aircraft is. And you have to be able to predict the winds. Right. And surprisingly, I thought the French did a pretty good job actually getting their supplies in that way, given the constraints they had. Yeah, that's a problem, dude. If you're dropping supplies from 10,000 feet, your accuracy is going to be pretty low, even today. I thought that was interesting as well. Now, the French were using some pretty cutting edge technology. When I say cutting edge technology, if you look at it today, it would be very rudimentary. But at the time, they were doing things that you see that we're doing today that have been refined with further technological advancements. But things like using of helicopters, I mean, the U.S. used helicopters in Korea, but we used them very sparingly, and we didn't have a lot of them, but they used helicopters. They had their aerial resupply techniques were pretty interesting, air traffic control, close air support, all of these things, even their communications were pretty sophisticated. What did you think about like their technological level going into the battle, you know, given where they were in 1953 and 54 as opposed to today?
I don't know. It still didn't bridge the distance gap. And even though, yes, today we are much further advanced in terms of, you know, the bandwidth and comms and everything, there still is the distance gap, and they still couldn't bridge the old size, weight, and power gap, and I don't think we can today either. We haven't answered that. We can talk much better. We can move faster, but things are still heavy. They still have to go a long ways, and it's hard to move them. And so haven't been able to bridge that.
I thought it was interesting on the technology side that both sides were listening to the other on the radio. Both of them had great intel and a view of the other side. You know, I mentioned that the North Vietnamese had the plan, the French plan, but the French had great ability also. They were listening to the Vietnamese, and they had every day the French were trying to drop the photos, and I thought that was really interesting, the photos of the Vietnamese positions and how that's going. So I don't remember any other battles where both sides had such a good picture of the other.
You're right. One of the technologies that I would say both sides were using was SIGINT, right? I think the French were probably using more technical means, and the Vietnamese were using less sophisticated equipment on SIGINT, but both sides were pretty sophisticated there in terms of what they were getting from the enemy. And you're right. You know, the French were using aerial reconnaissance planes to take pictures of the advancement of the Viet Minh's trench systems on their strong points, because they were using trenches to get close to the strong points so they could take them out easy. They were closing the distance that they would have to cover open ground. So all of that intel work was pretty interesting, and you're right. I think both sides had a very clear picture of what the enemy was doing. But what is so crazy is in the French case, before the battle even kicks off, before the siege even kicks off, they're like, eh, this is dicey. Like, we may not make it out of this. So let's talk about the final thing tonight. And I think this is one of the points of the book that I found most fascinating and maybe the most illuminating. And it's the connection between the war in Korea and the war in Indochina and how they were inexorably tied together.
Yeah, again, this was something totally escaped me, but he explains it in the minds of Western leadership. It's told through the Western viewpoint is, yeah, we are fighting communism in the spread of communism in Korea and in Vietnam at the same time, and the sting of the Chinese communists winning the Civil War in the late 1940s is still there. So it's a very real problem. Hey, we got to hold back the spread of communism. The U.S. is heavily committed, and the Chinese are part of both of this, same thing. The U.S. is heavily committed in Korea, so they are looking to the French. Well, you guys are the ones that want to hang on to Vietnam. That's your problem down there. There are limits to what we will do to help you solve your problem, which is interconnected with ours in the Western world.
I think there's this concept, too, that if one war ends before the other war, then the Chinese are going to be able to support the other side with more material, right? And it's just going to be transferred from one front to the other.
Yes. And remember, the U.S. was like, you know, so stunned that the Chinese were not going to permit U.S. armed forces to be conducting operations on their border and came pouring down the Korean Peninsula. So there's this idea of like, and we already know they're helping the Vietnamese. If they have the ability to redirect all that to Vietnam, they probably will. Don't be surprised if they do that, because they've already done it up here. Again, something I hadn't really thought about, but it seems plausible.
And on the U.S. side, remember, this is we've got the Korean War. The Korean War was not a popular war back home. And we're awash in economics, so we're great. You know, this is the 50s. We've got all this equipment from World War II left over. And our leaders, Eisenhower especially, they know the deal as far as militarily. They know the horrors of war. And so it is interesting. And like you said, we never really thought about it, or I never really thought about it, on how Korea and Indochina and the French are all tied together. But I don't think that Eisenhower was ever going to commit a lot of manpower to the French.
It was interesting that there's this, because we all know the U.S. did commit heavily to Vietnam later on. We know that. but this hesitancy of like, wait a minute, Korea is not very popular. We're trying to limit it, contain that war to the peninsula. We have manpower limitations. This is all telling us, hey, we are not going to, it leads us towards not getting involved in Vietnam. And they've got the appraisal of like, hey, you know, don't go getting involved in land wars in Asia. And they don't at that time. But France, we will help you with a lot of material support. And they do.
It's later in the book when they're talking about this, that both Ridgway and Gavin were like, do not do this. Do not get involved. We've talked in other books about go fever. You know, we always want to get involved. Here you've got the military leaders saying, this ain't a good idea. Stay out of this one.
And they're also looking at the French saying, wait a minute. If these guys are there and in a jam, just us showing up isn't going to mean it's going to go our way. And so there's the hesitancy. I found that a bit interesting, especially given the history later on. But, you know, they did help the French.
What the French did was wait until the siege was really starting to constrict. And then they knew that they had a significant issue. I think before then, they're like, okay, we can solve this ourselves. But when we get into later in the battle, let's say late March, early April, and it's not looking good, that's really when they send their folks over to the Pentagon and say, hey, we need some help.
That whole thing, he describes it, if they were still alive, it would be interesting to be able to talk to him. The French went through this continuum of the situation. They went in like, oh, we're going to set this up, use it for a mooring point, and we're going to really go out and interdict what the Viet Minh are doing. Then they get there, and they're like, well, our ability to go anywhere is very limited, so we're going to stay here, and we're going to defeat them when they come to us. Then they're under siege, and it's like, well, now we're going to defeat them, and that's what we're going to do. And then it's like, that ain't working, so we need American help. And then it turns into they're telling them, okay, we've gone from going in where we're going to interdict the Viet Minh to now like, oh, you got to hold on because you're our leverage at the armistice talks, and that's not where you want to be. And mentally, I want to know where they reached that tipping point, because they did.
So what it creates is this problem, right? And this is really, I think, the crux of the problem for the French. It's manpower. Their defeat is because they lack the manpower to do a couple of things. One is they still have commitments in Europe. They're still a part of NATO at this time. They don't pull out of NATO until like 1966. So they've got requirements there. They've got still a colonial empire, specifically in North Africa and other places in sub-Saharan Africa, that they have these colonies they got to take care of. And these liberation movements aren't isolated to Asia, right? They're involved across their entire colonial system, trying to maintain it post-World War II. They can only devote so many people to this particular deal. And that is really the issue. Because the Americans are saying, when they go to the Pentagon and say, okay, we need your air support to help us here. We got a significant problem. What we need is hundreds of four-engine bombers that can drop substantial amount of ordnance around Dien Bien Phu. And the Americans are like, yeah, we'll give you the aircraft. We have 100 aircraft sitting on Clark Airfield right now in the Philippines waiting for you to pick up. And they're B-29s, I believe. But then you got to think about the French, right? So now the net is closing on them at Dien Bien Phu. They got a month maybe left. How are you going to train air crews in a month, take those airplanes, take responsibility, take all the logistics that goes along with them, get them into the theater, and then use them effectively? Because the Americans are telling them, listen, we're going to give you whatever you need, but we ain't going to give you our people. The Americans gave the French an aircraft carrier during this thing. Not at Dien Bien Phu, but before. A full-up Essex-class carrier. Hey, just borrow it. You guys take it. So you got to think, from a French perspective, they've got to go get 2,500 sailors plus an air wing and integrate them onto a carrier that they don't own or have never owned before. They didn't design. That's not easy to do. And that's the problem here. The French don't have the time or people to solve this, and the Americans are unwilling to put their own people at risk. Now, there were Americans fighting here, by the way. They were contractors flying cargo aircraft and doing some pretty amazing things by all French accounts. They were quite complimentary to the U.S. pilots that were flying as contractors for them. This is the problem. They just don't have the manpower to do it. And when the United States signs the armistice in 1953, with the Chinese and the North Koreans. I think the French were a little bit taken off guard by that. Anyways, I thought it was a very interesting portion of the book. Let us close out tonight's show. Let us get to recognition and just shed some light on, you know, what people are doing out there. Kevin, any recognition this month?
Bill really got me thinking about how technology is advancing and the moving of porn. He was talking about, you know, the different collections he's had. So that in vain, I'd like to recognize the electronic media contribution to the free world. And excuse me if I mispronounce these names. Ukrainian native Yulia Sinyuk, who stars in adult films under the alias of Josephine Jackson, who with her colleague Johnny Sins, according to the press report, I wouldn't know personally, starts her video shoots wearing the coat of arms of the Ukraine and does, as she states, does her best to keep up the boys of the Ukraine.
Good for her.
I just thought that technology is advancing and this young lady is raising money and helping the people of Ukraine.
On this vein, I will just jump in here real quick. You know, I am reading Thomas Friedman's book, and he's like, you know, talking about the, you know, evolution of technology. He doesn't really get into how impactful like porn has been to the evolution of technology. It drives a lot of things in this world. In many cases, it's crazy how like it sits on the edge of a lot of that stuff. I can guarantee you in the future, because you'll see robotics in that world, you're going to see all kinds of crazy things. So we can talk all we want about it, but the reality is it drives the industries. So there you go. It's like the moon landing. Bill?
Didn't see that topic discussion coming up, but actually, you're right. We live in the information age, and there you have it. Before I get to my shout out, just two closing thoughts that come up here on Dien Bien Phu and the French in Vietnam. One is the bravery of the French going into this thing is never in doubt. And also, do a Wikipedia search on some of these guys in this book. They had all been through the business for a while. The one who's got to take his fake eye out before he jumps, the guy who's, you know, limps from his time in Buchenwald, and they were legit. And then as time goes on, there's still guys, even though when the siege is going on and the outcome really isn't in question, guys are still saddling up to jump in. But the other part is the direct connection between this, and I had never thought about it. He explained it. I sort of understood it between the French experience here and their attempt to keep Algeria in the French dominion. For the officers that were captured and marched off, they got the business from the Viet Minh on revolutionary struggle. They took that and took it directly to Algeria, and it influenced how they did things there. That was pretty interesting.
Well, luckily, we'll be talking with Pat, and we'll be reviewing a book on Algeria in the summer, so that's going to be a nice segue into that, Bill.
I look forward to it. But my shout-out this month is to Sergeant Stephen A. Sexton, who just took over as the 41st Color Sergeant in the Marine Corps. Good for him. Don't know a lot about the position other than you very visible representation of the Marine Corps. Interestingly, this billet was established in 1965, and the first person to hold it, Sergeant Eakin, was killed a year later in 1966 in Vietnam. So anyhow, good for Sergeant Sexton.
Well, my recognition, I've had two people. Both are, you know, they're not pleasant, but in terms of, it's always sad to recognize people who've passed away. But the first one is to Jack Klumpkin's mom. She passed away at 92 recently. She was a pretty amazing woman, was in a Japanese prisoner of war internment camp throughout the entire Pacific War. Her father died in that camp, came back to a war-torn Netherlands, and then eventually married Jack's dad after he got back from Korea as a company commander with the Dutch battalion that served in Korea. So anyway, she lived a very full life. She died at 92 and by all accounts was an amazing person. So our condolences go out to the Klumpkin family and may she rest in peace. My second recognition goes out to Mike Sadler, who died on January 4th, 2024. And Mr. Sadler was one of the founding members of the SAS in World War II. He was there on all the major raids and was the last survivor of that crew. pretty amazing life. When you look at his exploits during World War II, they were pretty crazy. He was at the big raid we talked about in episode one, Bill, where they drove the Jeeps onto the airfield and smoked everything. But his claim to fame with the SAS in North Africa was he was a navigator. And by all accounts, really took on board what he had to learn from celestial navigation to be able to drive across hundreds of miles of desert and hit a pinpoint target. Not only did that, there was a story where him and two other SAS men, I think they had to go more than 130 miles E&E, and he was a navigator for that. And they walked 130 miles on foot to get out of that Tunisia area where Sterling is captured. Anyways, by all accounts, a real deal guy. Went on to fight in Northern Europe with the SAS, which was pretty dicey. And then, you know, got out of the British Army and subsequently went into MI5 later on and had a full career there. But he died at 104, men. That guy was quite a star. So, anyways, may both of those people rest in peace and condolences to their families. Next month, gentlemen, we are going to review William Fowler's book, Operation Boris, which is the raid by the SAS to free nine British soldiers that were on a UN peacekeeping mission that were taken prisoner in Sierra Leone. A rebel faction called the West Side Boys had captured these soldiers, and the British did some negotiation with them. They could not get them released, and the SAS flew in with some of the parachute regiment soldiers and conducted a operation to get these Irish guards back. I think in the book, Fowler's going to describe kind of not only the British involvement in Sierra Leone that led up to the rescue, but he's also going to kind of give us some insight into the SAS deployment as well as provide a pretty detailed description of the raid itself. And I know, Bill, you've been to Sierra Leone, have you not?
I have. I've actually walked through the place in question.
Oh, so that'll give us some excellent color to what we're going to talk about. So please join us next month as we dive into another little discussed military operation. As always, Kevin, you might want to save yourself some money and go support your local library by checking out all manner of books like the one we're going to discuss next month. So, Kevin, any final thoughts?
Great book. Good read. Really reinforces the idea of how you can win battles and lose a war. You know, French paras, very tough. Legion, wow. And still lost Indochina. And I'd argue that they had the toughest small units on the tactical level, but lost it on the operation. But very good book.
Yeah, I agree. And Bill, you know, your comments on your thoughts on these guys. I'm looking forward to seeing many of the names again in Algeria as we read the book in the summer about Algeria. But my overall impression, I would just say this in closing from my perspective, was these dudes were legit. I learned a lot about the French army and their kind of perspective. The French paratroopers and the legionnaires that were at Dien Bien Phu were legit dudes. They had guys that rogered up to jumping in 2 days before the garrison finally surrendered at night into a small zone to reinforce this thing. So if you have people that are willing to do that, that is pretty impressive in terms of raw heroism. So anyways, Bill, why don't you get us out of here tonight so that we can go about our business?
Okay. Well, thanks for tuning in. If you want to learn more, please check out our new and improved website. It's up and running. No thanks to me, but just Google odinaesop.com, all one word, it'll come up. Still got the blog going there with links to additional resources. Got contact information if you'd like to get a hold of us. We'd love to hear from you. And then still got the PayPal link up and running if you'd care to make a contribution to keep things going. Be much appreciated. But thanks for tuning in and stay on the net out here.
Out here.